Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Welcome, everybody, to Beyond Surviving, the safe space for survivors of childhood sexual abuse to receive support, resources, and share their stories. Beyond Surviving is about freedom, healing, connection, and even laughter and fun. Most importantly, it's about letting go of the pain of abuse and finally moving on. I'm Rachel Grant, and for those of you who don't yet know me, I've been a sexual abuse recovery coach since 2007 and am the author of Beyond Surviving, The Final Stage of Recovery from Sexual Abuse. I work with survivors who are sick and tired of feeling broken and unfixable, and I help them let go of the pain of abuse and move on with their lives. You can learn more about me and the Beyond Surviving program at www.rachelgrantcoaching.com. And I am so very excited to have you here with me and my guest, Marilyn Vandiver, who is going to be sharing with us her journey of healing. And I first want to tell you a little bit about this amazing woman. She was crowned Miss America. Can you believe it? We have a Miss America here on Beyond Surviving. And then she graduated from the University of Colorado with Phi Beta Kappa honors. Marilyn chose motivational speaking as her career and was named Outstanding Woman Speaker in America. Marilyn's worst nightmare came true when she was 53. A newspaper reporter learned she was an incest survivor from ages 5 to 18, and the next morning it was front page news on the Denver Post. Can you believe it? Ugh. So miserable. And then when People Magazine put her picture on the cover, there was a national outpouring from survivors who turned to her for help and support. She opened the door for tens of thousands of sexual abuse survivors to also speak the words, many for the first time. During the past 13 years, she has been a busy gal. She has spoken in over 225 cities and never leaves the room until men and women have personally said everything they want and need to say to her. So it's not unusual, you know, for people to line up for 2 or 3 hours to speak words they've never spoken. And the healing that takes place during this time is often life-changing. The culmination of Marilyn's work is her book, Miss America by Day, which I really encourage you to go and get. It's a really wonderful story, and it's so honest, it's so real, and it also won the prestigious Writer's Digest Award. And of the 1,900 books entered into the national competition, it won first place in the most inspirational book category. So, Marilyn, it's not enough to say that it's an honor to have you here with us tonight. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Rachel, and thank you, and thank you for the work that you do each and every day.
It's good work. It's rewarding work. As and you're out there, you know, alongside folks like myself who are really advocating for survivors and wanting them to heal and to reclaim their lives. And, you know, to get us started tonight, what I would love is if you just tell us a little bit about your story, your journey, what happened to you?
My father started coming into my room at night when I was 5, and it didn't stop until I left for college at age 18. And I think what is so difficult for most people to believe or understand is that it is possible to repress memories. I had no memory of the nights of my life for 13 years. It's just, it's astonishing that your mind is able to do that.
Yeah.
But how could I go to school and get A's and be on the swim team and be May Queen and if I knew what I was going home to? It just, there was no way out. There was no one ever who would have helped me. I look back, there was no one. And so my mind was a magical place. I was able to repress the nights and go about my life, but the problem is that your subconscious rules your life. And so what it began to do was to make me do things that I didn't understand. For example, I fell in love with my now husband, Larry, when I was 15. He was 17. And he was a senior in high school. I was a sophomore. And he went away to college the next year, and we wrote every single day. Could not wait until summertime to be together. And he came home and came to the door, and I said, I'm leaving for the summer. You're leaving for the summer? Yes, I am. I'm going to Europe. So the next year, we ride every day, and the next summer he comes home. I'm going to go to summer school in Wisconsin. What I didn't know was that I didn't ever want to stay in my room again. And so I was finding ways to get away, but I didn't understand that. And he certainly didn't understand that. And then I married someone other than Larry. And I had met my youth minister when I was 15, the same year I met Larry. And for 9 years, my youth minister just, I just looked like the perfect teenager. And I was.
I was
everything that you could want me to be. But there was something that just didn't, it just for him, there was just a missing piece. No one would have seen it, but he did. And for 9 years, he would see me do something that didn't quite make sense, and he kind of tuck it away, wasn't really thinking too much about it, except that was odd, until I married someone other than Larry. And that really, because he knew how much I loved Larry. And he just, oh, wait a minute, what is she doing? And then
Something's not adding up here. Yeah.
I divorced after 3 months. And then he said, that was the ninth year, then he said, okay, now I understand she's trying to destroy herself. I just have to figure out why. And I had been Miss America, and I was working in New York. I was 24. And I would fly to Beverly Hills to do work in Los Angeles. And he had a church in L.A. at the time. And I would always call and say, hi, it's Marilyn. Just calling to say hi. I don't have time to see you. And he said, one day I realized you did want to see me, but you didn't want to see me. And he said, the next time you called, I knew it would be a different call. And I called him one day when I was 24. I said, hi, it's Marilyn. I'm in L.A. Don't have time to see you. And he said, where are you? I said, I'm at the Beverly Hills Hotel. He said, stay there. He said, stay there, just like that. And he drove as fast as he could. And it was about 11 o'clock, and the luncheon room was empty. And we went in there to talk. And it's like I don't remember anything until I looked up, and everybody's had lunch, and they've gone. He just asked me the question. He said there wasn't anything else. I'd been down every road. And you could not have, you've seen my book, so you've seen what my family looks like. You could not have imagined incest to be happening in my family. You just couldn't imagine it. And I didn't say anything. I just sobbed. I just sobbed and sobbed. I sobbed and sobbed and sobbed and sobbed until I was exhausted, and I looked up and I said, don't tell anyone. Mm-hmm. And his question was so brilliant. If I had said that to someone, you'd say, okay, I won't. But he didn't say that. I said, don't tell anyone. And he said, who don't you want me to tell?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Larry. And Larry was not in my life at this point. And he said, then Larry's the only one we have to tell. Well,
right.
I could never tell Larry. How could I tell Larry? He kissed me goodnight at the door from the time I was 15. I was a perfect teenager. So now Larry's going to have to connect kissing me goodnight at the door as a perfect teenager and then going down the hallway to my father. That's just, the shame was so overwhelming that I just knew I couldn't do that. And he got me to call Larry, and Larry said, I've come for 9 years. I'm not coming anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I hung up the phone, and I started sobbing again. And part of me was so happy that I didn't have to tell him, and the other part of me was so sad because I loved him.
Yeah,
and my youth minister said, give me the number. And I said, no. He said, give me the number. And he called, and he said to Larry, if you have ever loved her, I ask you to come.
Mm-hmm.
And so he came the next morning, and he walked into to Dee Dee's study with a legal pad. He's an attorney. He opened up his briefcase. He pulled out a legal pad, and he said, all right, tell me what I'm supposed to know here.
Mm.
And, of course, I'm just crying and waiting for Dee Dee to tell him. And Dee Dee said, Marilyn has something to tell you. And I sobbed, I can't. I just can't. Mm-hmm. And Dee Dee said, well, we will wait until you can. He understood the importance of my speaking the words. I'd never spoken the words.
He didn't
try to do my work for me. He said, we will wait until you can, because he knew that that's the first step. And I just searched for words, and finally it came out, and I just thought Larry would get up and walk out. I thought he would look at me with such disdain, such hatred, and he just put his arms around me, and he just held me, and he said, I understand everything now. And Dee Dee said, I'll marry you both now. And I said, I really have to get out of here. I really need to go now. It was just way, way, way. I couldn't marry Larry for 2 years. It took 2 years to finally be able to do that. But so that was the beginning of my healing.
Oh, my goodness. Marilyn, I would just thank you so much for sharing that. There's so much in there. And, you know, certainly in reading your story, you know, the love journey that you and Larry go on is so wonderful to watch. It's painful. It's agonizing. It's like, come on, woman. And, you know, but I love that this person, Dee Dee, comes into your life. And as I was reading that, one of the things that really stood out to me about that was the importance that someone, somewhere, somehow sees us.
Yes.
And, you know, notices and takes notice and becomes like they take a stand for us. Like,
yeah.
You are.
Yes.
I'm going to figure this out, and you are going to heal. You are going to be okay. And I think we all, you know, my hope is always that every survivor gets at least one person like that in their lives, because it does make such a huge difference and creates that opportunity as you're noticing that you to step in into healing. And one of the things that you shared there was the fact that these memories were not present. And one of the things you say in the book that I loved was you said, you know, I marvel at the mental gymnastics that allowed me to survive.
When my life shut down, when it really shut down, I was 45. And for the next 6 years, from 45 to 51, I just tried to get up out of bed. And on the days that I didn't think I was going to die or that I couldn't make it, I was so fascinated by the mind and how the mind. I had so much body pain, and because I had gone into a fetal position every night when my father came in, and tried to stay as tight as I could. And the problem was I couldn't let go of that. And I kept trying to find somebody to help me free my body. And finally, at age 50, I just said to Larry, I can't do this anymore. I need to check into a psychiatric hospital. And I did. I went to Cedars-Sinai and checked in there. And there was just no help at all. And I came back home, and I'd been to all kinds of different therapies. And one day somebody mentioned a therapist, and I was going to figure it out. I was going to get through it. And so all I remember about this man is that he was tall. I'm 5'8", so he was probably 6 feet tall. And for some reason, we were standing looking at one another. I don't remember why. And he said to me, are you sure you want to let your body muscles go? And I'm thinking, are you kidding me here? But I didn't say that. And my body, I kind of collapsed as if I were going to touch my toes. My body, my head went down, all the way down, and I whispered, it's all I have. And I realized that I was choosing to keep my body tight because it was all I had. And my mind was it was my mind that was doing that. And once I made that connection, okay, my mind is still choosing to because it's all I have to protect myself. I don't need that anymore. But I would marvel at the fact that my mind was causing all of my body pain. I just had to try to figure out why. I had beautiful long hair, and I believed that I won Miss America because of my hair. I believe that I got standing ovations because of my hair. I know that sounds so strange, but I believe that. And nobody could touch my hair. Nobody. Just don't touch my hair.
Yes.
My hair was
that's like
a sacred place. And when I was 40, I was flying home from a speech in Detroit, and I changed my ticket and flew to New York and had a woman who had worked on my hair when I did television work. And I went in and I sat down and I said, cut my hair off. And she said, what?
Wow.
I said, I want you to cut my hair off. And she said, okay. So she took about an inch. And I said, no, I want you to cut my hair off.
Right.
Take it off.
You're going all in, honey. Yeah.
And she just looked at me in such disbelief. And it was a long time before I understood why I had done that. When I was little, even as an 8, 9, 10-year-old, I set my hair every night in bobby pins. I just saw a picture of myself on a horse. I was 9, and I have this beautiful hair. But I set it every night with bobby pins. So my hair was the only part of me that my father didn't touch. It was the only part of me that was good. So when my life began to shut down, I was triggered by my daughter's age. When my daughter was turning 5, the age I was when it began, I flew to New York to cut off all my hair because now all of me was bad. All of me was bad. I cut off the only part of me that was good. Now, I didn't understand that at the time. I certainly didn't understand why I cut my hair. But as I went through my healing process, I could look back and say, oh, that's why I did that. Because it was the only part of me that was good. Now I was all bad. And that's that's when I began to really go down. Now, what I needed during during those difficult years of recovery, I needed to find a woman who had come through the healing process. And I would say to Larry, just find me one woman so that I'll know it's possible. Will I always be this way? Will I always just be just have anxiety that I can't cope with? Will I always just be sobbing? Will this ever end? Find me somebody. And it's one of the reasons I went to the psychiatric hospital. I thought, well, I'll find somebody there. Well, there was nobody there. I couldn't find anybody. And one day Larry said to me, role model for yourself. And so I began to visualize myself as healed from this horrible recovery process that we all have to go through.
Yeah.
And the last 25 years of my life, one of my major missions is to stand before men and women. I had a woman who is email me, and she was coming to one of my speeches, and she said, "I need to see you and touch you and know that you're real." I knew exactly what she was saying.
Oh yeah.
Did you really get through it? I don't believe it. And she came to my speech and waited in line, and she came up to me, and she just looked into my eyes. She said, "I'm the woman who emailed." And I said, "Hello." And I said, can you see, can you feel the peace that I have found?" And she said, "I can.
Yeah.
I can feel it, and I can see it." I said, "I got there, and you can get there too. You can." So
oh, Marilyn, I love that message because, oh, pardon me for interrupting, if I may, just real quick, because I think that is so, so important to emphasize for our listeners that part of the reason why I do this show, part of the reason why I bring people on and to tell about their journey is exactly that, that, you know, we all find ourselves in those places, in those moments of, you know, I'm never going to get better. This is just how it's always going to be. It's, you know, and it's hard if you don't really have a example out there of what it might look like, what it might feel like instead. So absolutely. It's so amazing that you get to hold that space for people and share that. Along those lines, go ahead.
Well, one of the good parts of one of the very few good parts of my story is that anyone who has followed me or has read my book knows that I have been to the bottom of the bottom of the well. They know I've been there. And so I come in with credibility. And when they can hear me and see me, they begin to believe it's possible. It's if you do the work. If you do the work. I answer 50 to 100 emails from survivors every day. And I'll have survivors say to me, "Well, I'm just too scared to do that." And I write back, "We're all scared. We're all scared, and we do it anyway. We do it anyway."
That's right.
"I'm scared to go talk to my brother." "Well, we're all scared, and we do it anyway." Yes, you have to do the work. You have to do the work. For me, that was confronting my mother, my father, my sisters. It was... And my father went to get a gun. You know, it was just all that drama.
All that.
If I had gone in anger, I think he would have killed himself or me or both of us.
Right.
We pulled out the gun. After I talked with him, he pulled out the gun. And he said, "If you had come in any other way, I would have killed myself." And I think that's true. I think if I had gone to him and said, "I'm going to expose you, I'm going to talk about this," I think he would have ended it right there.
Yeah. That was a really impactful moment in the book. And there are two things that come to mind. First of all, backing up to something you just said about facing our fears, you know, one of the things you write in the book is that the only path to sanity, peace, and healing is to face our fears. And yet, as you've said, and certainly as I've experienced in my journey with survivors, that is the very first hurdle of getting past that initial fear. And it is kind of a just do it moment. And also, I was wondering if there's anything else that you have found along the way in your journey that helps with that, that even if the fear is facing that, or sitting there, like that helps people to, you know, if they're shut down or terrified to do so, to get over that hurdle so they can get on the journey to healing.
Well, I have many survivors. One that comes to mind lives on the East Coast, and her first email to me was, "I'm going to kill myself. I can't." It's so interesting. People don't say hello.
Right.
"My name is Arlene, and I have 3 children and a dog." You know, they don't even say hello, Marilyn. It's just I really am going to kill myself today. They just go right into their stories, and you know, I email back and I said, "Well, that's a choice. Let's talk." And back and forth and back and forth and back and forth and. It's probably, I'm not good on time, I'm guessing 2 years. And today, she's doing so well. I mean, she's doing so well. She's forming relationships. We just kind of talked it through. We just kind of kept going back and forth, and she'd get a little bit stronger, and then she'd, you know, fall back. And I think communicating with people, finding people that you trust, yeah. that you can yeah. talk to when it gets really, really bad. You can't hold all of that in yourself. You need, what I do is just bear witness. People write me their stories, and I bear witness. It's getting it out. It's putting it on paper. If you don't want to talk to someone, then you need to journal, and journal and journal and journal. My recommendation always is to journal at the same time every day. You make a commitment. At 6 o'clock every morning, I will type for no less than 10 minutes. You can do more than that, but never less than that. No agenda. You just sit down, and whatever your fingers want to type, and you don't even have to read it. You just file it. And pretty soon, your subconscious knows you're going to show up. And pretty soon, I remember when I did that, I remember one day I typed and typed and typed, and then I read what I wrote, and I just lay down on the floor and just sobbed. I'd put it on paper. So
yeah,
you need to get out
that.
Of your, get it out of yourself.
Yeah, got it. That's really, really sound guidance, I think, because you just got to start somewhere. And if the somewhere is just telling a journal and talking about it there, then start there, and that's okay. And you'll continue to move towards, you know, the thing that you both need, and the next step and the next step, to get to the place of where you feel complete and whole. And I'd love to hear, you know, one of the things that you talked about a little bit, which is the day child and the night child. You know, this feeling of there being kind of a separation of self. And what I'm curious about, because I work with people who have some dissociation and these sorts of things, is does that still exist for you? Or in your journey of healing from 13 years of incest, do you feel whole? Do you feel complete? Or what have been kind of the key markers along in your journey that have helped you to know that you're healing and you're there?
When I was 53, and I picked up the Denver Post and my story was on the front page, I believed my life was over. I believed that people would turn away from me. I believed that no college would accept my daughter, no boy's family would want to marry into my family. I just had those were just all of my beliefs.
Right,
and
yeah.
What happened was I didn't have much time to think about that, because the phone rang and a woman said, "You will need to have a press conference." And I said, "I will never have a press conference." And she said, "Well,
yeah.
They're going to call your mother and your three sisters." And I said, "What time is the press conference?" So I had a press conference, and the next day it was on the front page of the Rocky Mountain News and the Denver Post, and they were calling my sister. So I called my eldest sister in San Francisco, and I said, "If you want to go public with this, do it, but don't do it in Denver, because we're never going to get off the front pages." So the third morning, her story was on the front page with my picture, and I said to Larry and Jennifer, I've got to get out of here. I've got to get out of here. And so we pulled on some sweats, and we went to the high school track, and we were jogging around the track, and the woman with her two dogs came, and we always said hello, but this time she stopped me. And she said, "Marilyn, we're so proud of what you're doing, and I'm so grateful your sister Gwen came forward this morning. I was really not happy about that." And I said, "Really, why?" And she said, "Because yesterday on our most popular radio talk show, people were calling in and saying, why should we believe her? Now that your sister has come forward, they will have to believe you." I looked at her and I said, "If people are not going to believe 53-year-old me, then who is going to believe a child?" And that was the moment that changed my life. I went home, I called the newspaper,
Damn.
I called the television stations, and I said, "Let's get to work. Here we go."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I've been talking to the press. I'd been talking to the press for about, maybe 10 days. And one day I'm talking to this reporter, and he said, give me something new today. What you got? And I said, oh, my. I said, I'm talking to you today, and I don't have any shame. Mm. I don't feel shame. I was done with it. I was proud of who I am. I was not hiding anymore, and I was not shamed. I was proud, and that was another really life-changing moment.
Oh, man, that's really awesome. The other thing that you mentioned a little earlier about the conversation that you had with your father, where you laid it on the line and said, I know what happened. One of the things that I thought was really well discussed or just highlighted in your book is the complex relationship that exists. That, you know, here it is, it's your father. There's the father-daughter relationship, and then there's the abuser-victim relationship. But it's not so black and white, because you certainly turned to your father many times for guidance and even consolation, you know, and comfort in times. And I thought that I really so appreciated that you spoke to that, because a lot of times people who haven't been through abuse, they don't get it. They're like, oh, just, you know, cut them out of your lives or forget it. But at the end of the day, he's still your dad. He's still your mom or still somebody who you love. And I wonder if you could say a little more about that, Marilyn, just what you've noticed in your years and in your journey about how we as survivors deal with that complex, you know, those layers of the relationships and that go on.
I think it's one of the most difficult things that I've ever talked about. Let me rephrase that. I think it's one of the most difficult things for people to understand. Mm-hmm. I loved my father, and my father is all I had. I didn't have anybody else. I had no relationship with anybody but my father. I had no relationship with my sisters. I had no relationship with my mother. My father was all I had, and it was arsenic. But he was also the only person who ever heard me, he did like four things for me in my life that were understanding, mm-hmm. but that's four more than anybody else did.
Right.
And right. I really did love him.
Yeah.
And I know that is difficult for people to understand. That changed only... it began to change, but that ended the day that I found out. Because when I went to talk to, I was 40 when I went to talk to him, mm-hmm. and he said, "If I had known what it would do to you, I never would have done it." And mm-hmm. I clung to that. I really clung to that. You know, if he'd known, he would not have. And I was the youngest daughter, so you know, I knew that it was over. And when I was 56. I received a letter from a woman in Denver who told me that my father had sexually violated her about 20 times when he was 75. He died of a heart attack at age 76. My father knew exactly what he was doing. And that information was, that's one of the most difficult letters I've ever read in my life. He never stopped.
Yeah.
That was just overwhelming. And by that time, he was dead. He had died.
Mm-hmm.
That was very, very, very hard for me. What was hard for the people who love me was that I had more anger for my mother than I had for my father. I was the opening keynote speaker. I was the opening keynote speaker for the men and women violated by priests. It's called SNAP.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. I opened with, "You're angrier at the bishops than you are at the priests," and they're all shaking their heads. Yes.
Mm.
We're angrier at the person who did not protect us and knew it. I had much more anger for my mother than I had for my father. And I also didn't have any relationship with my mother. So there was no mixture there. It wasn't as if I love her, I don't love her, which I had with my father. My father, I would say to my husband, Larry, "I feel this way, I feel this way." And one day he said to me, "Take the white off of a golf ball And you'll see these rubber bands that are so intertwined, you cannot pull one out. That is how you feel about your father. You have all of these mixed emotions that you can't pull one out and say, I love him, I hate him. You have all of these different emotions. That was not true with my mother. That was not true with my mother.
Okay. When you finally decided, first of all, yes, because certainly having worked with survivors for some time now, I navigate this issue as well. It's like, well, there were the people who were standing by, and something about that, you're watching this happen to me, and you're not doing anything, feels almost 10 times worse, because here's my take on it. When we're little and we're being abused, we don't have any choice. We don't have any power. We don't have any say in it, even though we try to tell ourselves that we do in order to survive or cope. But at the end of the day, it's a big person, little person problem. And this other person in your life, whether it be an older sibling or a parent or an uncle or somebody, you know, a neighbor, they're a big person. And there's this such an incredible frustration that they have the position and the power to do something that you don't have, and they don't.
If my mother had, I turned to her when I was 48. Mm-hmm. I went to the same breakfast room where I had confronted my father when I was 40, and I went to tell my mother. And I was sobbing so hard I could barely utter words, but I got the words out. And when I looked up, not only was she not consoling me or had her arms around me, she folded her arms and said, I don't believe you. It's in your fantasy. And during my recovery, which again from 45 to 51, those were the six really hard years, I turned to her a number of times during those years. I needed my mother. I was feeling the emotions of the child. If she had been there for me at that point, if she had said, I am so sorry, I didn't protect you. She came in one day and I was crying and she said, I have no tears for you. I can feel nothing for you. She just could not, I'll give you even a better example. When it was on the front page endlessly, it was on the front page six times. It was on the newscast morning, noon, and night. Mother and I only talked about it once, the first day that it came out. And even though I had her and my mother-in-law for dinner 3 to 5 nights a week, every week, I love my mother-in-law so desperately. Oh, she was such a good mother. Even though it came out that he never stopped, even though it came out that he had a gun, all of that was, and Mother read the paper every day. She never said a word to me. And 3 months later, I was asked to testify before a subcommittee in Washington, D.C., and some of my testimony drifted back to Denver, and Mother called. Mm. And she said, you said something today that really bothered me. And I thought, boy, I just can't wait to hear this. She said, you said your father pried you open. I said, I did say that, Mother. They're saying he molested me, and I thought I needed more vivid words. And she said, please don't say that again.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what got her.
Yeah.
She made a choice. And she didn't choose me. And I didn't get a mother. But I got a mother-in-law. I was given a mother. It was just in the form of my mother-in-law. Whom I loved and adored. Mm-hmm. She was just, she was the most nurturing, kind, loving, had no comprehension. She really couldn't go there. She just could not imagine a father would do that to a daughter. It was just beyond her. I really don't think she could think about it. I just think she just shut that out of her mind because she just had no understanding of how that could possibly happen. But she was very nurturing to me. And I could talk to her, and she would listen and love me, and she was just a very special woman.
So, Marilyn, how did you make your peace with that? Because this is something that comes up in my conversations with survivors all the time of, I wanted a mom. And I talk about, well, you didn't get to have a mom. Like, you didn't get it. Your mom didn't have mom things to give. And you can get, you know, you can find care and compassion in other ways from other people. And sometimes they'll say things like, well, it's not the same. It's never the same. And I think that's probably true, but I'm really curious how you came to that place of feeling acceptance and feeling complete about that, and could, you know, look at your mother-in-law and have that kind of space filled from that relationship. Can you say a little more about that?
Yes, what was so difficult is that I saw her so often. To 5 nights a week is just, that's just a lot. And I saw her very often, and she just, you would have loved her. That was part of the problem. She was beautiful, she was engaging, she had a wonderful sense of humor. She was delightful to be with in terms of company. I don't want you to picture some frumpy Grinch. She was charming. Everybody just adored her, which again was part of the problem, because that's not the mother that I got. But one day, and I don't remember whether it was the day she said, I have no tears for you, I can feel nothing for you, but it was a day like that, when I went into my mind and I buried not only the mother I never had, but much more difficult, I buried the mother I never would have. And I buried her. And I put on my armor when I was going to be in her presence, because she would say things. One day we'd had dinner and Larry was in the kitchen, and Larry's mother was there and my mother was there, and something came up and mother turned to me and said, well, you've just never, it had to do with religion. And she said, well, you've just never been tested. And she would say things like that, that were just so hurtful. And so I would put my armor on and try to let her, these comments that she had, ping off of me rather than go inside of me. So I would, when she was coming over, I would be prepared by putting my armor on that she was going to say something just quite, in such a lovely way, just a lovely way.
Right.
It was like a knife in the back. And I would have been prepared for that by putting my armor on. And most of the time, I could kind of let it go. Just not let it get inside of me anymore. I didn't get a mother. Okay, well, but look at what I did get. Oh, my goodness. Are we going to think about what we didn't get or what we did get? Did I marry the most amazing, wonderful, loving, kind man? We tried to have more children. I was only given one, but we were given one. We had one.
Yes.
Am I going to be angry that I didn't get five? I got one. So I think it's just important to focus on the blessings that you do have. Yes, it's sad that I didn't get a mother or a father. I didn't, and you know what, Larry and I were talking about this yesterday. I didn't have any friends. Now, you wouldn't have known that, because I was May Queen. I was student council. I went to Girls Nation. I looked like I was in the middle of everything.
I didn't have any...
I couldn't have close friends because my secret was too big. And when they have college reunions, and I was a Pi Phi, I went to college. Pi Phi's nominated me for Miss University of Colorado. Why would I go to a reunion? I didn't have any friends that were meaningful. I couldn't because my secret was so huge. I miss that. I see that with other people who get together with the friends they grew up with, and I do miss that. I don't have any childhood, teenage friends other than Larry.
And I miss
that. But I ended my book, I think. I wrote it so many times. I think I ended it by saying, my life has been richly blessed. And someone looked at that and said to me, you're really going to end with your life has been richly blessed after you've you've just poured out this nightmare you lived. And I said, but my life has been richly blessed. Mm-hmm. Richly blessed.
Yeah.
Would I choose it again? Would I choose to go back to do the work I'm doing today? I would not. It was way too hard. But that's the hand I was dealt. So was I given a privilege for my story to be on the front page of the paper? It took me a few days to figure that out. I didn't get it until I saw the cover of People magazine. There's my picture on the cover of People magazine. And the caption said, Miss America overcomes shame. It didn't say Marilyn overcomes incest. It said Miss America. Okay, now I understand why I was Miss America. I never wanted to be. I never wanted to be.
Right.
Okay, now I get that. Overcomes, it doesn't say incest or rape. It says shame, because that's what it's about. And I looked up and I said, because I had asked, I had never had a relationship with God, because Mother was always on her knees with her, like a child with her hands folded. When I went down to my room, she was on her knees praying. Well, whatever was working for her wasn't working for me. So I didn't have Jesus or God. I didn't have anybody. But when I was about 51, I looked up one day and I said, hello. I actually said, my daughter, to myself, okay, here's the deal. This is the way my daughter talked. Okay, here's the deal. I want to help, but I don't know how. So if you give me a job, I will do it, whatever job you give me. Well, I got a job right away, and I'm thinking, oh, no, wait a minute. No, you didn't understand. I'll do a job as long as nobody knows it's me, okay? So I do have some qualifications on the job. So I knew the minute I got the first job, I knew that was the job, and I did it. It was really hard. And then I was given my second job. I knew it immediately, and it was really hard, and I did it. And then I looked at the cover of People magazine, and I looked up, and I said, this is the big job, isn't it? Okay, I got it. And that's, I believe that I was put on earth to do the work I'm doing. I believe that. I believe I was Miss America. I believe that's why I became a motivational speaker.
Yeah.
Because this is the purpose. This is the purpose I was given for my life.
Yeah. Well, there's so much that is beautiful and wonderful about what you just shared. You know, one of the first things that I like to work with all my clients is what I call their highlight reel. Because it's so true. When we are in the pain of healing and recovery and everything looks pretty bleak and difficult, we forget that there are things in our lives that are beautiful still. Even if, I say sometimes, even if it's just the fact that you got out of bed today, or the sun is shining, or there's a, you know, pretty flower, it can be the smallest, minutest thing. But by keeping our attention and turning our attention to those things, it does help us come into the place of hope, but also I think what you were also talking about, self-acceptance and acceptance in general, that this is just how it is, and we have a choice about how we're going to respond to that. Are we going to be broken and fall apart and be miserable for the rest of our lives, or are we going to get the support that we need to heal for sure and begin marching towards what's next? And that all of it in some way lines up somehow. You know, exactly what you're saying. You know, you were given this, you know, position so that when your story came out, people wanted to listen, people wanted to notice, people wanted to read it and hear it. And it positioned you to be able to now go on to where you're, you know, taking care of email every day, 50 to 100. I don't know how you do that. I'm going nuts with, you know, 25.
You know, I cannot wait. I wake up in the morning and we go work out, and then I come and go on my website. And I have emails from China, from Ireland.
Yeah.
I mean, just fascinating. And a woman who you'd know her name in a minute, from Washington, D.C., not hello, Marilyn, we've never met. Not, it just, they start right in with the story as if we had been talking for 10 years. And it's just such a privilege to be able to be a part of people's lives, and that they trust me.
Yes.
If word got out for this woman in Washington, D.C., she trusts me, and that is so precious to me that she can. I spoke in Syracuse, New York, and people line up, and I sign books. And this man came up to the table, and I looked into his eyes, and I said, "Could we step aside for a minute?" And I said to the people waiting, "Would you give me a minute, please?" And we walked off to the side a little bit, and I looked right at him, and I said, "Who was your violator?"
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at me, and he said, "My older brother. I know he looked to be about in his 50s. I don't think he had ever said those words before. I just don't think he had ever said those words. And to be a part of having someone speak the words, maybe for the first time,
right,
and to trust you enough." I do want to go back to one thing that we were talking about my having mixed feelings about my father. I am very close to a woman who's 42. She was violated by her brother, 7 years older, and it was very detrimental to her life. She's one of four children. The only relationship she has with her siblings, that is, she said, he's the only one I'm close to. And she said, I know nobody could ever, how could anybody ever understand that? How could anybody ever stand? Look what he's done to my life. I mean, it's been so hard for me.
Yeah.
And yet he's the sibling I feel closest to. He has the most interest in me. And it was so interesting because her husband said to me, he never meant to hurt her. And one of the reasons I keep speaking, one of the reasons I keep going, and I do, I keep going and going and going, is because 14-year-olds, 14-year-olds comprise the largest number of sex offenders of any age group. And he was, like this Duggan story that's going around now, this boy was 14. And in every speech I give, I say, go home and talk to your children. And do you know what they do? They go home and they talk to their children about inappropriate touching. And it's just so important for us to sit down and talk to our kids and say, this is what's appropriate and this is never appropriate. We have to talk about it. I asked a 15-year-old in Denver how many hours she had to spend to get a driver's license in Denver. 56 hours. And I say to parents in my speeches, to whatever audience comes, how many hours do you spend talking to your teenagers about what's appropriate as they grow into their sexuality? 56 hours to get a driver's license, really? And you know what? They listen. So I had a man say to me, it was a tux dinner, a dressy formal dinner, and this man came up and he said, okay, I hear you. I know I need to do this, but I just don't know how to start. And I said, well, what if we start with the truth? Last night I attended a dinner, and this woman told me that I should have a conversation with you kids, and I don't feel really comfortable about doing it, and I hope you feel more comfortable talking to your kids, but we're going to have a conversation. I said, can you do that? He said, I can do that. So there he goes.
Yeah. Nice. Oh, thank you so much for that, and oh my gosh, we could have a whole long series on how to talk to your children and how to raise awareness, but it's so true, and I'm so glad you brought that forward in our conversation tonight, that, you know, the biggest thing that we can do to end this epidemic is to educate our little ones.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And, yeah, it's so, so important.
I heard my grandson was 6, and he was in a playroom with some other kids, and I heard him saying, don't touch my privates, don't touch my privates, and he was laughing, but he knows what that means, and that may be all he needs to know at age 6, but he did know that at age 6, and he needed to know that at age 6.
Yeah, well, and I think one of the things that you bring forward then is, it's not even one 56-hour conversation, it's a conversation over a lifetime, because what you teach the 6-year-old is different from what you teach the 10-year-old, from what you teach the 12-year-old, the 15-year-old. So it's an ongoing dialogue that we need
It's also watching television and saying, what he said to her right there, That is not okay.
Not okay.
That is
not okay.
So we have teaching moments all the time, constantly.
Yes.
We're in the car and we see someone shouting at a man shouting at a woman or whatever, and we say that is not okay. No one should treat someone like that.
Right.
So it's a daily education.
Love that. Absolutely love that. So, Marilyn, as we start to get close to our time together coming to an end, is there any, you know, kind of final thought, anything that you'd really like to leave the listeners with this evening?
I just think that the hardest thing that you can think of that you need to do is what you need to do now. And
oh my gosh, that's great. Yes.
It's partly listening to that voice in your head that never stops. We know what our next step is. I had someone say to me, I want to talk to my brother, but my therapist thinks I need to talk to whatever. And I said, you need to talk to your brother. you're talking about in your head, what keeps going around in your head, this is what you need to do. And is it hard? Yes, it is. Yes, it is, each and every time. Each and every time I disclosed, I felt like my life was ending. But each and every time, I had to know if that person was still going to accept me. And I went from person to person, one at a time, sister to sister to sister, sister-in-law to sister-in-law. You know, just one by one by one, I would have these one-on-one conversations, each time thinking that person would never speak to me again or would, you know, just think I was awful. Because I had to know, am I acceptable, really? And I was in my late 40s. I was enormously successful professionally. I just couldn't find respect for myself. That took some time, but I did the work. I did the work.
Yeah, beautiful. Man, I really love that. And I really want to encourage everybody to take that to heart, because that is some gold advice right there. You know, that's definitely worth like a $200 therapist session. Just that little piece right there.
Well,
and
I'm impressed that you read my book. Good for you.
Of course. And I expect other people to read it as well. Go out there, pick up this book, Miss America by Day. You can get it on Amazon. You can go to Marilyn's website, www.missamericabyday.com, and read more about her, connect with her. You can add to her list of emails. Be reading. You can.
I love it.
So accessible and so available.
It's what I do.
And
love it.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you can always visit me at rachelgrantcoaching.com as well to check out the resources that are there. And again, Marilyn, it's been such a pleasure and such an honor to have you on as our guest tonight. So thank you very much from the bottom of my heart. And until we meet again, take very good care of yourselves. Good night, everyone.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.